Hello, beautiful people. This is Pierre, and this is Through the Fog, the podcast I host about finding our way through the proverbial fog. Today, I have a special guest, one of my friends, PJ Clarkson, and he has written his first book. It has been wildly successful, and being only launched a couple of weeks ago, it has already sold out, and they're busy on the second print run. The book is called The Bok Way, a book about the culture behind one of the most successful rugby teams the world has ever seen, the Springboks. He went and interviewed a bunch of players and people who are part of the wider team behind the Springboks about how they created that brilliant winning culture. This is an excellent conversation, even though I know almost nothing about rugby. The information and tips and tricks and methodologies behind the culture of the Springboks is immensely valuable for you and for your team and for your business, of course. You can find PJ's book in all good bookstores and all the usual e-commerce sites. This is my conversation with PJ. Hey, PJ.
Hi, Pierre.
Where do you find yourself today?
Physically, I find myself in Melkbos. Just came back from school. Every morning, me and my son walk to school. And then in the afternoon, I walk to fetch him and walk back, which is a really cool thing to do because I don't think there are many other places where you get the opportunity to do that. The reason for that is that he's 15. And he can walk on his own, but I just know I don't have that much time to spend with him anymore.
Yeah.
That is a nice opportunity for me and him to just be together, to talk.
Yeah. I mean, that's really cool. I mean, I do the same. I love walking. Mm-hmm. So I love walking as much as possible. And then our CrossFit gym is really close, like 1 kilometer away. And we've got a really small grocery store like 500 kilometers away and our local coffee shop, and then the kids' school is opposite the road. So I love walking, and we moved into this neighborhood because it's a walking neighborhood, because mm-hmm. that's a luxury these days.
It is, absolutely.
Live in a neighborhood or a place that's just like a walking space. And with your 15-year-old son, do you have is the walk long enough to have interesting conversations
with him? Since he was 4 years old, the same answer you get in terms of what happened at school today. Never has there anything happened at school. They never learned anything. They never did anything. They're never doing anything new. That's always his answer. So yes, the walk is long enough to get his full download of the day, because he tells you nothing.
His full download, which is nothing.
Absolutely nothing. It has to be exceptional for you to say, the other day he said they got free ice cream, which he liked. And that's a thing that he told me. Apart from that, I never know what is happening at school. So, in the afternoons, he's a bit tired. So, we walk in silence often, but it's still cool to spend time with him.
That's awesome, man. I know presence goes a long way. So, for everybody listening, this is my friend PJ. We've known each other for quite a while, a couple of years now. And in the coaching, mentoring, speaking, writing, now writing world as well. So, PJ recently wrote a book, which is freaking awesome. And so we'll get to that as well. But before we get to that, who is PJ?
I'm somebody who likes people, I think. I'm somebody who's always found people interesting. And I've spent a large part of my life trying to figure out people and try to help them to not suffer unnecessarily. So I've got a background in psychology. And I remember how I got into psychology was, so my son, the other day at school, they did the assessments and stuff to help him with subject selections. And I remember when we did that at school.
I remember both.
Aptitude tests and stuff.
Aptitude tests. And then mine said, you can do anything you want.
Yeah.
And I was like, what the hell? Give me back my $1,000.
But you have been doing anything you want since then.
What kind of stupid answer is that? Anyway, so back to his aptitude test. What did they do?
Fashion and design. Same as you.
Cool. That's awesome.
He's really good at making clothing and he loves it. He has incredible knack for it. So my mom's family, all a bunch of creative people. They make clothing. They make music. They make movies and TV shows. And they make furniture and they make things out of iron and wood and stuff. And he absolutely also has that talent. My mom taught him how to sew when he was about 6 or 7. And he's brilliant.
Wow.
He just loves to do that.
Yeah.
When I think about myself, when I was doing the aptitude tests when I was 15 or whatever, they asked you at the end of it, what do you want to do? And I was sitting there and I thought, I don't know. And it just jumped up, psychologist. And I thought, yeah, man, that's the answer. And that's been the answer ever since, because I just enjoy people. And they also frustrate me. We were talking earlier about you having some frustrating people in your life currently. They do. And I know I also frustrate people across their path every now and again, but I'm at my essence somebody who cares about people. And my work has for a long time been around helping people get out of their own way, helping teams get out of their own way, and helping organizations create environments in which people can do great work. Because I've been fortunate enough, when we first met, you came to talk at our company, which was, I think maybe that was in 2014, 2015. And the company that I worked for then was a fantastic place to work. And I realized that not many people have that privilege. Later on, a couple of years later, we started our own business, helping other companies to recreate good environments to work. So that's from an interest perspective, but I'm also somebody who loves sport. I love learning. I love reading. I recently realized that I love writing more than I actually thought, which was a bit of a surprise. I think in a smallish nutshell, that is who I am. I'm somebody that wants to contribute to the betterment of the people around deeply, and I have a conviction around that. So in whatever way I can find to do that, that's what I try to do.
Yeah. That's quite awesome. I remember you sharing with me one day that business that I spoke at, I mean, yeah, literally more than 10 years ago. I can't remember the name. I suppose we shouldn't mention them. that you started having office lunches. So you were the one to instigate the everybody should eat together every day, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
It wasn't you. Yeah, it was you. Yeah.
Yeah, it was me. Well, it was me and my friend. So what happened then was when I got there, I started working there in 2011. And the culture was incredibly fearful from my experience.
Yeah.
People were afraid to step out of line. They were afraid of getting punished. And I remember just after I started, one lady made a big mistake on one important project and she was fired. And that sent these ripple effects through the company. And I mean, that was a significant mistake, but that I think made people even more fearful. And it just felt as if everybody was sitting in their shells there and they were sitting behind their desks just quickly eating and they just stuck to themselves. And me and my friends started this thing where we said, like, why? I mean, it wasn't like we made a conscious decision to change the culture. It was just something that happened organically. But we started saying to people, there's a space, let's go and sit there and have lunch. And that's where the culture changed, where people started to join us. Initially, it wasn't everybody. It was a small group of people that felt the freedom to go and sit there because, I mean, been eating at my table forever. What if my manager doesn't like this? And then people realized, oh, it's fine. And they joined. And there was a rule that you were not allowed to talk about work while you were sitting. And the result of that was people started getting to know each other. And from that, the WhatsApp group emerged. So we were just in communication almost constantly. And it changed that culture of that company significantly, where it started to become, and I hate it when people say it, it started to feel like a family. Because even when we work with companies, we don't tell them to do that. It's not a family, it's a team.
Yeah.
But people got really close to each other. And I mean, I've not worked there since 2020. The company has closed down in the meantime, in any event. But there are still people that I worked with there that I talk to every single day today. And we will remain friends for the remainder of our lives, I believe. And that just pulled people together and helps the organization to do really fantastic work. We were able to attract fantastic talent. We kept the people. The company was successful and just love that. I mean, there's such a, when we talk to companies about how can you enhance your culture, one of the easiest ways to do it is to get people to eat together. But people don't listen. They just think, well, this is not going to make a difference. But I absolutely guarantee that it does.
Yeah. No, absolutely true. Like there's a, I think I've said this on this podcast before. We've talked about this with some of the guests before. It's like keeping this idea to keep the table at the center. And if you want to know how to raise great kids, keep the table at the center. Just keep the table, like make sure that you have dinner together around an actual dining room table, around a table with no phones and no devices, and do it often, every day if you can, but at least more often than not. And then you do whatever you want. It's almost like you can, if you have dinner with your kids every single day around a table, you can actually let them go and do whatever they want, because culture is imparted at the table. The culture and the values and the morals and all those things are imparted at the dining room table. And the same is true of business. Like keeping the table at the center. Like it's absolutely freaking true. I love that story. I remember that. That's very cool. So it's a good, it's like a good segue for the book, because like obviously you love people and helping people get out of their own way. And then you've now written this book called, titled The Bok Way, right? So, and this book is about the culture of the Springboks, the Rugby World Cup winning Springboks, those Springboks, right? So where did this idea, how did these two worlds find each other in the end?
So because I do a lot of cycling, I listen to a lot of podcasts because you need a way to pass the time. It's quite boring just sitting there. And I do the same
route. That's why I don't cycle. So that's for me. Like, that's why I don't cycle.
That's for me so a way boring. to keep it fresh. You do the same route every day, but you're listening to something new, so it's a new experience.
Sure.
Yeah. It helps. It makes a difference. And luckily, the views are fantastic, which is also a big benefit, but not in winter because you can't see anything. It's pitch dark. The world's met. Well, given this type of work that we do, I mean, you're looking at the world through this lens and you have an idea around. I have that knack where I talk to people. I ask them about their work and what they do, what it's like, because you always want to know about that. And you can learn a lot from very short answer in terms of what people are experiencing at work. And then you listen to podcasts where some of the Springbok players talk about what it's like to be a player in this team. And specifically, the book focuses on the team coached by Rassie and Jacques Nilobba since 2018. The team before that was not a successful team. It was a very poor Springbok team. And then these two guys came in and a lot of things changed. And now they've won the World Cup twice. They have a really good chance of winning it again in 2027 next year. And then you listen to these people talking and you watch shows like Chasing the Sun and you view it with a lens of this is what they do, given the fact of what we do for work. And they tell you a lot about the way they go about things. And I don't know if you remember, it was in first quarter of 2024 I met with you, because you're one of the very few people that I know have actually published the book. And I asked you, but how do you go about this?
Yeah.
We met somewhere in Century City, I think. And the idea has been in my mind for a while, because there is a lot that you can learn from this team to go and apply where you work, because these people are obviously very successful. And they are a good example that you can learn from. And I had the idea, and it's a funny thing. It was at the start of 2025 last year. It was quiet and I was sitting at this desk and thinking, but how do you do this? And I went to the bookshelf there and I looked at books and I thought, I don't even know a publisher's name. Let me find a publisher's name and go to their website and look at what do they look for. And I went to the first one and they have their submission criteria. And I thought, well, yeah, I can do that. You have to write three chapters and a synopsis and whatever. And it takes me about 2 months to do that, I think. I send it off and you get a generic response back that says, if you don't hear anything in 6 weeks, the answer is no. And after about 3 weeks, somebody answers me and says, looking for something else, asking for some info. And I answer them. And then a senior editor answers and says, have you sent this to anybody else? And I said, no, just you guys. And they said, okay, hang on. We have a meeting. Month's time or whatever, we'll get back to you. And long story short, they give me a contract to write the book. And yeah, on that and day, I realized that, wow, okay, so now if I'm going to write this book, I need to do it properly. So I want to interview some of the people who work in this environment. But I don't know any of them. I mean, I don't know Ikara Springboks personally. And I go through all of my networks of people that I know, and they organize it for me. And nobody said no that I approached to talk to them. Nobody. The answers were all yes. Love to talk to you. And ended up talking to Jock Nienaber, who's won 2 World Cups with the box. He's probably going to come back for the 27 World Cup. I guess it's likely. I spoke to Steven Kitsoff, who played in 2 World Cups. I spoke to Skark Brits, who played in 2019, Francois Lowe. Annelie Murray, the lady who's the PR manager for the box for 20 years. She's one of the most capped people in the Springbok setup ever.
Oh, yeah.
She worked with 7 coaches, spoke with her as well. And they told me all about how this team operates. And
yeah,
write the book, and it was published at the beginning of March this year, and it's been fantastic. I mean, it's been a wonderful process, and it's been very well received as well.
Yeah, no, amazing. Like, I've heard you're already on the second print.
Yes, it almost sold out within the first 2 months. They had to go to a second print.
That's incredible. It's like proper. It's like proper bestseller. I was a drive. And I see all the speakers everywhere go, "Oh, bestseller." And I was like, I know it only sold 200 copies. I know you're a liar. But it's really great to know there's actually a bestseller. That's freaking awesome. So tell me, what is the central argument of the book, like the central thesis? What is the idea that you wanted to convey with the book?
The central idea is that creating a excellent place to work doesn't happen by accident. But it's also not something that is outside of your grasp. You can actually make it work. And the thing about the box, I believe, in speaking to them is, yes, they are really good at the technicalities of playing test match rugby. Rassie is really fantastic at understanding how the game works. But they spent an equal amount of energy and time on creating the environment for those people to flourish within. It's not something that happens by accident. They are very deliberate about what does it feel like to be a part of this team. And they take that equally seriously as what do you actually do on the field. And what I did with the book was to break it down into bite-sized parts so that people can look at their environments and see which of these components are there. Why does it matter? So this is the thread that runs throughout the entire book is, what's the principle at play?
Yeah.
How do the box put it into place? How do they actually do it? Then in each chapter, I give another example from another business, which is not rugby or sport related necessarily, to show, but it works like this in other environments as well. And then component on what can you do to boost this specific thing where you are. So those things run throughout the entire book. I try to explain it simply as best I can, and then also give people the tools to go and do it themselves should they want to do
that. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Before, let me ask you this question. So before researching this book, how did you think the Springboks worked? And how is that different to what you think now?
Initially, I thought it was just because the players are really good. And the coaches
like just
are really,
really good rugby player, really strong guys.
Yes. And it was almost an accident of, we now have this group of talented players that you come across once in a generation, and the box are just lucky. But getting to talk to them and listening to the specifics that they talk about in terms of what does this team actually put in place, there is nothing that they leave to chance. Nothing. They control absolutely everything they can. They plan. I don't know if Rassie ever sleeps, really. They are just constantly planning for every possible thing.
Yeah.
And making sure that all the bases are covered and nobody can get caught off guard. And yes, the players are fantastic and they are coached really well, but these guys work their balls off to make sure that it works and to stay ahead of the curve. That is very insightful. And I don't know if anybody can work in that environment, because it is a very high responsibility, high requirement environment. It sounds like it is taxing to be a part of that team. Yes, you get the rewards because your team wins and you become a world champion, but the workload is enormous.
In what way?
Attention to detail in terms of taking responsibility for your own development. So that is a really cool thing that Jock Nienaber told me.
Yeah, I saw that. What is it? The pakkie, draai jou eie tassie, like carry your own.
Yeah, draai jou eie
tassie.
Carry your own bag. Draai jou eie tassie means that you are there to do your job. You are not there to comment on how other people do their job. Your job is to do your job. And what they learned, so that they were at Munster, Jock and Rossi, 2016-17, coaching there. And Ireland only has about 120 professional players. We're in South Africa, there's more than 1,000. So
yeah.
if one of our players doesn't perform at the top level, you can just pick another one. In Ireland, they can't. They have to develop every single player they have. And what they learned there was the level of responsibility that each player takes for their own development and their own skill set. So what he said was, when they started coaching the box, they would have team practice. And 2 minutes after team practice ends, the field is empty. You would have one or two kickers picking poles. The other players are doing whatever. And they taught them that team practice is for getting the team to play together. The rest of the time is for you to develop your own skill set. So they give every player their own homework. And you know exactly what you need to do to develop yourself. So if me and you have to work on our tackling technique or line out lifting or whatever, that's our job to organize with the kit master and with some other players that we need so that we can practice our skill together when the team is not practicing. Or if we need to work on jackling or whatever, we know what we need. So they help you design a drill, practice your skill. But it's your job to find the time and the kit and the stuff to go and do that, and the players that you need alongside. They spend a lot of time focused on developing themselves. And incrementally, the individuals get better. And when you put those components together, obviously the team is better as a result.
Yeah, that's amazing. How do you think this would translate into a business? People would be really pissed off if you give them homework.
In a business, the people that you work with, and I can think of the people that I work with as well, how much time are they actually spending on enhancing their own skill set, do you think? Or are they just doing the things that they've done since they started working there? Do they have 20 years of combined experience, or do they have 20 years of 1 year experience? I don't know if people are actually required to enhance what they do continuously. I know there have been times in my own career where I've just done what I've done the same way I've did it last year and the previous year, because that's what you need. And then things happen that are pressures from the external forces that force you to learn new things and to adapt and to get better.
Yeah,
but for the most part, I think most of us are just going to be happy to keep cruising and doing what we know how to do.
Yeah. And that's really dangerous, right? I was reading an article on Hannah Arendt. So Hannah Arendt is a philosopher, and she lived about 100 years ago. And then she wrote on work this beautiful book called The Human Condition. I'll find the link and put it in the notes. So she wrote this book, and then she defines, there's like three stages. And she says the first one is labor. So labor is where you do work because there's work to do. So, and it's cyclical. So it comes from working in a factory or working on a farm. So you're harvesting because it's time to harvest. And then next year you'll do the same again. You're harvesting again because it's time to harvest. In a simple way, it's like you wash the dishes because new dishes is piled up. So then you do the labor.
And it's not a continuous thing that's always going to be there.
Yeah, it's always going to be there. It's always repetitive. It's always the same. You do the work because there's work to be done, right? Then the second layer, or one step up, is what she calls work. So work for her is linear. She says work is when you're working towards a goal. So you're building something. So when an industry, or not an industry, a business is busy building a product. So you're building a product, you start, you build the thing, and then you launch it, and then that's work. Or you build a new type of service, or you invent something new, or like that. So this linear idea of work. And then the last one she talks about is action, which is a really interesting one. So action, and I think what you're referring to, this sort of self-development, almost falls into the last bit. So the last bit is where she gets a little weird in her book as well. Action is about deciding who you want to become and then actioning that over time. So self-improvement, living into the future shape of PJ, like that sort of ideal version of yourself, the version you want to become. And that's action. And her hypothesis was, and 100 years ago, she said that all meaning is getting lost because all work has sort of devolved into labor, where labor is only this thing that you do because you do it. You've been doing it the same way every year or every month or every week, or every day. You just show up at your work, do the same thing, go back, do the same thing. You're just submitting reports because it's time to submit the reports or whatever it is, right? Mm-hmm. And it kind of sounds like that in a way. And that's really dangerous, especially in an AI world, because if I can predict what you will do next week, then I can probably automate that. It will be a lot cheaper for me. So I think that's freaking fascinating, like that they kind of get homework and then it's expected that you develop yourself. I love that. That's great.
To your point, just a quick point on that. So I think the hypothesis sounds closely through, because we keep ourselves busy with what we are supposed to be keeping ourselves busy, or we think, and then the rest of our time we are spending very often on stuff that's just there for short-term entertainment and not on development. Mm. And the result of that is we actually just stay the same. So we're not necessarily doing the work of evolving towards the person we can become. We just do what we need to do, and we do it begrudgingly, and then we entertain ourselves in the meantime until tomorrow or after the weekend or after the holiday. So I can understand from that perspective why there is such a lack of meaning in the world currently for a very, very, very large part of the population.
Meaninglessness crisis. Yeah, absolutely. I think there's one thing in your book as well. You talk about purpose, like the shared purpose or shared goal of the team, right? And then I think I read a quote from Rossi once that said, this is a funny story. I was actually in line to do the audiobook for Rossi's book.
Okay.
Like when it first came out, because I was doing voiceover work during COVID, and then to make extra money because everything went to hell. And then during that time, they were like, oh, we need an Afrikaans guy, somebody that can do Afrikaans and English. And then I was like, I almost did Rossi's book, which in hindsight, I'm glad I actually didn't, because I know actually very little about rugby. It's very funny. But it's just ironic that we're having this conversation. But anyway, I've read this quote or heard this quote from him where it's like, when you pull that Springbok jersey over your head, you're doing it for South Africa. South Africa needs this win. The people back home need this win. And remember, especially in 2023, I mean, it was like hairy in South Africa at that point. Like, it was like load shedding and the elections and all the kind of craziness around that time was really, really hectic and crazy. And the box just had this way of pulling everybody together, like the shared purpose, but for South Africa. What did you find in your interviews or in your writing about that idea, the shared purpose? Like from the outside, we think like that's what they did, but how intentional is that or inside of the team?
Very. They seem to be talking about it all the time. So when they came back, the coaches, 2028, they spoke about the team needing to be transformed. And we think about transformation as the demographics of the team needs to change. They thought way more broadly. Yes, it was demographics, but they also changed the demographics of the support team and everybody involved who worked in the team, coaches. But they changed the culture fundamentally. They have changed a lot of stuff in terms of how South African rugby works, how the governing body works with the Springboks. So there's a lot of administrative and technical stuff that has changed. The team composition has changed significantly. I mean, the team looks different than it did 10 years ago, although there's a lot of the same players still. But it was a big focus on we need to win while we are transforming for South Africa. They talk about it all the time. And I think the first thing that, yes, if the team doesn't win, nobody's going to, I mean, nobody cares. You can say whatever you like. You can do it for South Africa. I mean, the FANA can't say they're doing it for South Africa because they're not a winning team consistently. So they won't have that impact. But the fact that the team now better represents the totality of South Africa makes an enormous difference. There are people that look like each of us in that team. They have stories that are similar to ours within that team. People from townships, people from private schools, people anywhere in between. They look like us. Within the team, Steven Kitsoff told me, when they do Monday morning analysis, after a test match, if you did something really well, you won it. a turnover or whatever, they will say to you, you made your country proud. If you did something stupid, they will say to you, you let your country down. It's not like you did a stupid thing. You let your country down by giving away that penalty.
Yeah.
That's the way they speak within that environment. And he says on the field, when they're playing and they're busy and they're doing whatever they're doing and they can see a player getting a little bit lost or not paying attention, they will say to each other, do it for your country. Do it for your country. That is part of their way of speaking in that environment. It is not just for the team. It's not just for the group on the field. It is for the country. They are completely convinced of that. And I think it resonates with South Africa as well. I mean, this team is incredibly loved and popular in our country, but I think across the world. You hear a lot of players, so I mentioned this in the book as well, when they speak to foreign players about why do you play for your team? What is your team all about? They talk about the team. They talk about that entity, which is the All Blacks, for example. They don't talk about their country. They don't talk about anything bigger than what happens within that specific environment. So these guys are unique in the sense that they make a big, big deal of it, and they believe it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's such a powerful principle. This one, I spoke about it this morning, actually, in a meeting. The universal is always accessed through the particular. So it's this rule or this kind of universal law that I learned from Dr. Leonard Sweet, like years ago. And it's this idea that when you go to war, when somebody goes to war, you're not actually fighting for your country. You're fighting for the person back home. And then it's like that the box when playing that particular game has access to the universal. So you're making the try, which is a small thing, but then that actually gives you access to the whole big world. And that's such a powerful thing. Like, what are you actually doing? This small thing, you're doing it for this. Like I said, works kind of both ways in a way. Like you're winning the war, but you're winning it for the small thing. You're doing the small thing, but in doing that, you're actually winning the war. So, or, you know, doing the country, helping the country. And it's true. Like, I mean, any South African would tell you that rugby or sport is really what holds this country together. Like in times of when it was great, everything was on a knife's edge. It was literally like a rugby game or some of the other sports, you know, as well, that was like holding the country together going, well, that's the one thing we can all still agree on and also kind of cheer for if it's the very last thing that's left. So again, I mean, I'm going to ask you this a couple of times, but like there's a lot of founders and execs and so on that listen to the show and email me afterwards, and then it's like how do I make this practical in my business, you know, because I can't keep on telling everybody, you know, you let your country down when you didn't like send the invoice on time. how do I translate this so it makes sense for me, for anybody that's maybe a business owner or a founder listening?
So we get the same question that you would get. And when we talk to companies, and it is really about remembering, but why are you there in the first place? And getting back to that first perspective of why does this matter? And being honest about that. The example that I use in the book that is a non-rugby example is from Sasco. And I remember on one of our walks to school, one of their trucks came past us with the new logo on it, or the new slogan that said, people who care make things better. And I thought, man, I like that. I hope that's true. I hope they are people who care and they actually make things better. And went to their website and looked at their stuff. And it seems to be the thing that they care about to do.
Yeah.
We care, and so we make things better. And I think from a company perspective, is really getting honest about, but why are we actually here? If we are just here to make money, be honest about it. It's fine. If you want to create a hell of a lot of wealth for your family, just say that's what we are doing. And think according to that unified way of thinking. It doesn't matter what it is. It's just more important that everybody knows why they're showing up and they are pulling in the same direction. And that's what the box really do. Yes, they have their own personal ambition. They want to earn money for their families. They want to make their dad proud. They want to create a legacy, whatever else there is on a personal level. But the overarching thing that binds all of this together is it's for the company, for the country. And we very often, as humans, forget why we do what we do. I mean, we forget on a personal level. We forget on a collective level. If we can remind ourselves regularly enough and honestly so, then we can pull in that direction. It's a North Star, what the purpose of it is. It's just remembering what your actual North Star is.
Yeah. Or Southern Cross, seeing like it's the box.
Yes.
How do you find that purpose? Like sometimes, I mean, purpose is a big word in business often, and there's some parts of it that sort of get some people are kicking back against that idea that you have purpose as your strategy or as your main kind of driver. And sometimes people do it terribly. Like there's I won't mention the name because I don't want to get sued, the mayonnaise company that talked about how their purpose is now eliminating food waste. Because they make leftovers taste better. And I'm like, you're lying. Like, that's not why you started. You started because mayonnaise is freaking delicious. People love mayonnaise, you know? So sometimes it's reverse engineering of purpose that happens in businesses. And then it just ends up terrible. Like, you're going, that can't be true. Like, you're, you know, making sticky tape. Why are you talking about saving the world? Like, that's... it doesn't actually make sense. So how do you find that or unearth? Maybe it's unearthing or maybe it is finding. I don't know. Like, how do you find that purpose? How do you go about that as a business?
I think it's the same type of thing, that the same process you go through to find it on a individual level, because it does exist on an individual level. The example that I use, so in the kitchen, is we have this very wide, shallow drawer with all the stuff. It's that drawer that everything goes.
Yeah, the second drawer.
Yeah.
My mother calls it the second drawer. Like every house has a second drawer and every life also has a second drawer.
But this thing is about...
all the crap, you don't think about
it. All the crap goes in there. Yeah. But this thing is about a meter wide and it's full. And I don't know how many utensils are in there, probably 8. But all of them are useful for something. You just need to know what to use it for.
Mm.
From a personal, on a personal level, it is, I think companies struggle because a lot of people that we speak with, and you probably have the same experience, that most individuals that you speak with, they don't know why they're on this earth. They don't know what they are here to contribute. They don't know why they really want to do what they do. And when you pull people together as a team and there's a bunch of people not knowing, they're just going to go through the motions. So I think it depends on also, I would say, a company in terms of, so a lot of the companies we work with the founders. And they can tell you exactly, this is why I started this company. Yeah. Last year, we had an event with a client of ours who turned 20 years old. And the owner and the founder of the company told this very emotional story around where this company came from. And it is such a fantastic story to hear it from his own mouth and in his own words. And the people really pull around that was the people that want to contribute towards this.
Yeah.
If it's a company that is, you know, older, bigger, it's very easy for that to get lost. But I think it can, around the current leadership, if they are clear about what it is that they care about and what they want to contribute, that can be the thing that can pull people together. Because you want to get people to think about the things that really fire them up. And what are they there to contribute? And if that can align, that becomes powerful.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think? Even how would you answer that question?
Would I answer that question?
Yeah.
I think the what you care about question is the question that I ask businesses or I ask teams. So what do you care about? Not, and then that for me is the clue to why this thing exists or, you know, the purpose. I sort of avoid the word purpose mostly, but... why this thing is relevant, or Rich Mulholland would say relevant. So why this thing has purpose, or why it exists, right? So, and then what do you care about? What is the impetus? What is this, the origin story? So often with older businesses, I think the businesses I work with, the one is about turning 100 next year. And so the founders are long dead. And why is this thing still going? Like who? And then when you dig into the origin story of it, it becomes so powerful for people. And often they resonated with it deeply. But to be fair, I must say, I know I slated the mayonnaise company, but if that group of execs or team actually really do care about food waste, you know, that can totally become the purpose, I suppose. Mm-hmm. I don't think so. But like, I think like maybe, you know, that could become it. Like, because you're relevant to the matter at hand, right? There's a relevance to it, as Rich would say. So that's what I talk about caring. I talk about stories. One of the things is like asking people, when did customers love you? Like, when did people just absolutely love you? And when did they hate you as well? Like, people don't like answering that question because then often they'll go, nobody hates us ever.
Yeah.
That's definitely not the truth. Mm. When did customers love you? When you did this, when you made this product, this service, that thing. Well, that's a clue towards your purpose or your why or your relevance. And then what do you care about? What are the values? And then those, a mix of those things then to show up for me.
I remember we spoke to a lady that worked in a subsection of a bank that I won't mention. It was a bunch of years ago. And they were in the lending component of the bank. And they said that they were there to safeguard and to help the financially at risk. That's what they said. That's why we are here. There are a lot of people in our country that are financially at risk and they are indebted and we want to help. The way in which they rewarded their employees was to make sure that they sold as many personal loans as possible to the people that are already indebted. That's how they actually played it out. So we want to help you, we're going to get you into debt deeper and deeper and deeper. So that for me was an enormous misalignment between what you say you are there for and what you are actually doing.
Yeah.
That shows up.
Yeah, that's because, I mean, values is one thing. But then actually the behaviors is the thing that matters, right? Because, I mean, Andrew, other friend Andrew, he would always say, I can tell you about how much I value family time. But if you walk into my home and we never eat dinner together, then that doesn't matter. So, and that's a big shift, like in the businesses about you and I work with, like values on a wall is one thing, but like the behaviors, how people actually behave in the corridors or around lunch or in communicating with each other daily, like that's the real thing.
My example around values around the box, non-rugby example is from Steinel.
Yeah.
One of their first values was stakeholder responsibility. Yeah, they spoke about we care about people that all of our stakeholders and they mentioned it. And that was completely the opposite behavior of the leaders, specific leaders of that business. There was just responsibility towards themselves. So yes, most companies are not that crooked, luckily. But yes, on a personal level, we do say one thing and behave a little bit off of that. Something every now and again.
Yeah.
Getting people to really firstly know what they value and behave accordingly is rare, but that is the point of understanding what you really care about.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. So did you find anything in the box that sort of, in a way that they align behaviors and values specifically?
Yes. Yeah. They do it very practically, which is really cool in terms of they talk about when they do alignment camps, for example, they have a 14-point selection criteria to determine whether somebody is going to be a part of this team.
Yeah, and 14.
14 things they look for. And how well you play rugby is number 12 out of 14.
Really? Number 12?
Yeah.
You think it'll be at least like top 5?
Yeah, number 12. And these things are ranked.
So even I can apply. So even I can apply.
It's more about character of the person than the ability, because these coaches are good and they believe that they can coach anybody to be a better rugby player. And they probably can. But they care about you. And the first thing they look for, are you a warrior? Or what is the size of your ego? Those are the preeminent things they look for. Because somebody with a massive ego is not going to be a team player. If they tell you, you're only going to play out of the 4 test matches the Boks are going to play against the All Blacks, you're maybe going to be on the field for 10 minutes. But we need you to contribute in this way, off-field way. If you are just driven by ego, you're going to say, no, not going to do that. So they want to see how big your ego is and how likely are you to contribute to the betterment of the team. And the warrior thing, which for me was a really cool, the way in which they measure that is something that is called battle stats. For the amount of time you are on the field, they calculate how many positive impacts you have on the game. So making tackles, hitting rucks, carrying whatever it is. And they can quantify your warrior level in a way. So that it's very practical around, okay, so are you actually living the values? We can see because we can measure it and we can show you. And we can show that this guy has a better score than the other guy. And a lot of the stuff So the ownership, for example, is something that they brought in, like I said earlier. And they said initially it was perceived to be incredibly plastic. That's the word that Jock and Norman used, because it is something that they are not used to doing, but they encouraged them to start living this way, to start developing yourself. And the players felt like, but this is not the way that we do things. And they just said, just do it. And then they kept doing it, and now it is normal. Now it is just what they do. So now it has become, how much time do you spend developing your skill set? A lot. I could show all of the stuff that I did. That's the value. That's a way of measuring the way that you actually do things. So there's a streamlined way, in a way where you can align, or you can see whether they're actually doing what they profess to believe in. I think it's made practical, so people can know what to do.
Well, amazing. That's very, very cool. Like, I mean, that ego thing is so interesting, because one of the things that, I mean, even I noticed, and a couple of people noticed, is at the final in 2023, people who were left out of the final match completely, nobody complained. And nobody afterwards, you didn't hear anybody say, well, why didn't you play me? Why wasn't I on the field in the final? I made all the way. No one. Not one. And in the past, or with other teams, you'd hear that in the news afterwards. Like, why was I left out? There's politics, there's this, but not with the box. They're not like that. They behave in a completely different way. That's super fascinating. Battle stats. I like that. It's like, so my friend Sarah, she was also on the podcast a while ago. It was the culture queen. She always talks about every problem is a people problem, and every people problem is a system problem. Because if your system isn't measuring and rewarding the right things, you'll have a people problem, which will create all the other problems in your business. I think that's
teaching people,
so
really should be.
Yeah. And the system rewards accordingly. And then people mess that up so much. Like, exactly like the example of the bank you just gave. So you were saying one thing, but you were incentivizing the opposite behavior. And sometimes inadvertently, because it makes so much sense, right? The business makes money dishing out personal loans. So that should be the metric. You know, but what other metrics are there that you can use if you're saying that this is your mission and this is your purpose? And all those things aligned. And what I've seen often as well is people incentivize individual behavior, but they expect team behavior. And then if you're working together as a team, you don't get rewarded as a team. You get rewarded as an individual. Why work together as a team? I've seen that more than once in a business, which is a classic mistake. Tell me about there's one thing you wrote a little bit about, where you're a work in progress. And that they've got a culture of growth. What does that mean? I mean, you're a rugby player. Where do you want to grow to? You're the Springboks. You're like top of your game.
That's the process of, you need to get better all the time. And what they really do well is, which is incredibly unique, like you said, not just incentivizing personal performance. Lucanio Am, for example, he played in the final in 2019. In 2023, he was injured before the squad was announced, and he came into the squad later during the tournament. And he won a medal, a winner's medal. He's got two winner's medals. In the 2023 World Cup, he played 0 seconds. He was not on the field for 1 second. His job was just to make sure that the other players who were playing were well prepared. And that is the collective growth mindset that they have around, my job is to make sure that everybody else in my position is getting better. So they play across the entire world. They know different ways of playing. They learn different things and systems. And they bring it back to make everybody else around them better. So Scott Brits told me, he's probably the oldest player that I spoke with. When he played for the Lions and Western Province before he went to England, he spent most of his career in England. There would be four hookers, for example, in the squad. And throughout the week, prepping for a game, they would try to injure each other in practice to make sure that I got the best chance of playing. So I actively wanted to hurt you so you couldn't play, so I could get the jersey.
So you can get the jersey.
Yeah. So that's the exact opposite of what this team is doing now. Is, yes, we are the box, but there are always minute things that we can improve on. And that is my responsibility, to keep improving all the time, to make sure that when we put the collective together, it is a better collective than just what we were a year ago.
That's crazy. I can't even believe that. Well, I suppose I can believe it. Like, if you're incentivizing people, like, you want the jersey, then there's three other guys all wanting the jersey.
It's just one jersey. Let me go and get that jersey. It's mine. That's exactly the same example that you used. There's no teamwork in there.
That's crazy, man. That's crazy. Okay. The second part of the book talks about people. Like, we just quoted Sarah, so all problems are people problems.
Mm-hmm.
And you speak a little bit about trust. So, I mean, I speak about trust as well often in team settings. I'm sure every single coach or consultant does. It's like the trust is the foundation of everything. You know, Patrick Lencioni's 5 dysfunctions of a team. Trust is the foundation. If you don't have trust, you can't have healthy conflict. If you don't have healthy conflict, you can't have commitment. And then you can't have accountability. And then you can't have a goal, right? The classic five kind of tiered thing. How do they build trust in the Springbok team? When somebody wants to take your knee out because there's only one jersey.
So I asked all of the players that I spoke with, what was the biggest change that happened when these coaches came in? And they said, Joshua Lowe referred to it as, what was the word he used? I think it was something like brutal transparency, something like that.
Yeah. Wow.
So previous coaches, you would have no idea as a player where you rank in the pecking order according to their thinking. You would just know I'm doing well in their thinking if they pick me again. So these guys came in and they put up an Excel spreadsheet in front of everybody and they say, this is how we think you rank in terms of position. And everybody sees everything together. And you think, this is how good you are. And now thinking that's where you rank. You disagree, tell us why. And in that way, everybody hears the same story. There's no, you hear this and you hear this and I'm going to promise you that you're going to play, but actually you're not going to play because I'm going to get this guy to play. They tell the truth brutally. That is how they start to build trust. It's a starting point. They do more than that. The other things that they do is they take care of each other. I mean, that is a very strong component of that team. Where the coaches, how can I put this? Rassie is not their friend. Rassie is not the guy who hangs out with the players.
Yeah.
Jock Nienaber is more the friend type of guy. Somebody said, Rassie, you can talk to Rassie about rugby. He's always there. If you want to ask him a question about rugby, he's going to talk to you. But he doesn't know when your birthday is. And he doesn't necessarily know what's happening with your wife. That sort of thing. That's not his job, he believes. Jock Nienaber does those sorts of things. But the players take care of each other. And the players know each other. And the players care about each other. And they have each other's back. And they help to develop each other. So that builds trust within that environment. The other thing that they do, for example, is if everything goes according to plan. So they have their schedule for the entire year. This is when we are playing against which nations. If we don't have injuries and we don't have red cards and things, that is when you are going. So they tell you, you are going to play third test against the All Blacks. So that you don't have to go and destroy another player's knee to get into the team. You know what you are aiming for. And they hold each other accountable towards that. That's how they build trust. There is nothing to hide, it seems. There's nothing that happens behind the scenes that does not need to happen behind the scenes. Other things that they do, for example, is they open the team coaches' meetings to every player. When the coaches are having their meetings, the players are allowed in. The only thing that they are not allowed to attend is selection meetings. Because the coaches want to figure that out on their own. But the players know what to expect. They know what they are going to be doing every day. There are no surprises around what type of training they're going to be doing. Everything is planned. Everything is out in the open. Really, it is what you see is what you get to a very, very large extent. And if that is the case, why not trust? I mean, it's just what they tell you they're going to do, they actually do. And everybody does the same.
Yeah. It's actually so profoundly simple. It's telling the truth. It's like those things. I always tell people a joke and say, well, your mother taught you. It's like, you want to know how to build trust in the team? Well, your mom taught you. When you make a promise, you
keep it.
Keep it.
Mm.
And then if you if you made a mistake, you say you are sorry. And then you fix it. Mm. And it's amazing how people would not own that. they avoid that. That's super, super, super interesting.
Mistake making, that's a really cool thing, what they do. When the team messes up, Rassie takes the blame. With the media, with everybody, he says, I fucked this up, I'm sorry. That's what he does. He protects his players. And they trust him. Behind the scenes, they go and figure out what went wrong, why we lost. But the other cool thing that they do is they, when they look at this, so they analyze everything to the minutest detail, but they characterize it as one of three types of mistakes. The first one is system error. You did not know what you needed to do. So that is the responsibility of the coach and the player to figure that out together, 50-50. I didn't coach you enough. You didn't know enough. Let's work together to make you a smarter player, better equipped.
Yeah, yeah.
The second one is a skill error. You didn't have the skill to do the job. We're going to work together to improve that 50-50. The third one that they don't want is an effort error. You were lazy. We lost because you were lazy. You didn't get up quickly enough. You didn't get into position. That is a thing that they don't want to see. So that goes back to the battle stats at the start. Are you a warrior? Do you get off the floor quickly? Do you get back into position? Do you bail at your friends if they make a mistake? And I think the way in which they handle mistakes creates a hell of a lot of psychological safety in that environment where people are not thrown to the wolves, figure out what they need to do. And as a result, that builds enormous trust. People are not fearful. They can go and they can play. And when mistakes happen, either one of your teammates is going to bail you out or you're going to figure it out to get. But you don't have to be afraid to try stuff.
Yeah. Because I can imagine, like, there's so many, I mean, I'm just thinking, my mind is like reeling about how many times this happens in business contexts or in other contexts where the fear of making a mistake, because you don't know what the consequence will be. Like, what level of consequence will I have when I make this mistake, or if I make a mistake? Is it going to be one of these three things? Like, I really like that system skill and effort, right? Those are the three. And those are actually really good categories, and they could be good categories perhaps even for a business as well. Is this a system mistake? Is a system not showing up? Is it a skill, like you don't know what to do and we didn't train you well enough? Or is it an effort and you were just lazy? I think those are really great categories for a business as well. And if it's clear beforehand, then you can play or work without fear. Because you know that it's not all on you, and you're not going to get blamed for something that wasn't your fault or only your fault.
Mm.
That's something wider. I think it's just freaking brilliant. Love that so much. That's really awesome. What else did you notice about the leadership? I mean, that comment about Rassie taking public responsibility is quite a thing, and you see that all the time. I mean, that's very real. Mm. He's not blaming and saying in front of the media, saying this player and that player, and you know, this the union or the whatever. Like he owns it. What other skills did you notice in the leadership that was really remarkable?
The players spoke about how hard the coaches work. They set the tone in terms of the work ethic. They are incredibly well prepared, and they are always working on something, and they are always figuring new things out. And then they come to the players and they show them things. A bunch of the players said that they don't think anybody can outwork those coaches. So they set the tone. They are, if you think about the culture of growth within the team, they set the tone. They are not the same coaches that they were a year ago, 2 years ago, 5 years ago. They are constantly getting better. The other cool thing that they do, which is different, but I think it's brilliant, is they share the load. In terms of the responsibility. Because there's so much to do in prepping for a test match. But same thing as a business. They help the players have a very clear role. So 15 guys who start, they know what they need to do. 1 to 15 within that team, they know what they need to do. The 8 guys on the bench, they know what they need to do. But then you've got a bunch of other players that are not in the match day. So they give each of them a job as well. For example, they would give, I've heard Thomas de Toit talk about this, and Trevor and Yokani, who are front rowers, the guys who scrum. It's their job to analyze the referee that will be refing the match on Saturday and figuring out how does he penalize scrummaging. And then they have to prepare a proper presentation for the team and come present to the team, this is how this guy refs scrums. The coaches don't have to do that. The coaches share the responsibility of preparing the team for the test match. which I think is brilliant. So yes, they do a lot of the work themselves, but they also keep everybody engaged by giving them meaningful work to do. So nobody feels like they're just holding bags or just hanging around or just making up the numbers, which for a leader is a very, very scary thing, because most leaders that I know want to hold on to all responsibility. They don't want to share the load. They want their people to do more because they feel very tired often, but then they don't have the trust in allowing other people to do the work to help them very often.
Mm.
I found that to be absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. Wow. That's fantastic. That's super fascinating. You wrote a bit about brotherhood as well, but friendship. I'm really passionate about friendship. I think it's one of the most debased metaphors in our world since Facebook started, that you can friend and unfriend, and it's so awful, and it's a word and a concept that deserves saving, and in such a lonely world, it's more important than ever. What did you find about brotherhood and friendship?
So given the fact that the coaches are not necessarily friends with the players, they do encourage those players to be friends, to get to know each other.
Yeah.
But also wider than that, they encourage family within the environment. So the wives are friends. They take care of each other's kids. It is an ecosystem of family that they create there. It's support. So the 2019 World Cup, we played England in the final. Francois Lowe was playing for South Africa, but he was then playing for Bath, which is an English club. And he knew the players who played for England. And their wives were allowed only within 5 kilometers of the team hotel, not closer. That was the rule. When our guys played, their wives sleep in the room with them. Because the coaches say, I trust you, you're an adult. Your kids are there, your wife is there. You know what you need to do to show up to be the best player. We want you to be a happy player. You're going to be happy when your wife and your family is there. And the players also say it helps them a lot, because they're not just hanging out with each other, talking about rugby all the time. After training, go see your wife and see your kids. If they are there, you talk about other stuff, which takes the load off significantly. But they care deeply about each other. So I talk in the book about not being a family. It's not something, I don't like the idea of a business being a family, but it's a team that cares for each other. And companies can be that as well, because you always need to earn your spot on the team. It's not something that you just have. You need to earn it.
Yeah.
And if you are there, take care of the people around. One of the other cool things that they did purposefully, which they said also was initially felt quite plastic, was when Rassie was a player, for example, played for the Cheetahs, and he said in one of his interviews that when you get to the box, the Cheetah players would all hang out together. They dislike the Blue Bulls players. They never spoke to them. But they're part of the same team, but they're always just, you know, in their own little cliques. So when these coaches came in, they said to them, senior players can't live together. All the guys from the Sharks can't live together. All the colored players can't live together. It is your job to go and talk to everybody. You don't just hang out with your friends. Go and make friends with everybody. And everybody's encouraged to go and meet everybody else and hang out with them and get to know them. And when they do the training on their own, for example, they would see that Quagga is training a specific thing. And a young player would see, oh, cool, Quagga's doing this. Can I join you? Yeah, man. Fall in. And then they train together. And as a result of that, they form a lot of connections within that team to make everybody feel like they belong and like they are part of the team as quickly as possible. Because if you walk in as a new kid or a newly selected player and there's all of these closed off cliques, I mean, it's like moving to Cape Town, as me and you know. It's very difficult to find your space within that. But they are purposeful around being open to say, come in. And we don't just hang out with the people we know already. And as a result, you are open to forming more friendships, obviously.
Oh, that's incredible. That's really incredible. I mean, I also heard the stories of the 23 World Cup from the hotel manager, where the Springboks were playing, and how there was like the kids in the pool and running around down the hallways and the wives everywhere. And it just makes so much sense, like versus this ridiculous notion that no women allowed or no wives or partners allowed, you know. I don't know if we've got any gay Springbok players yet, but like no wives or partners allowed. And also like who else, if you're the partner to a Springbok, who better to support you than another partner of a Springbok? Because living that life and that world must be so difficult and so different than to what any of your other friends are experiencing. it just makes complete sense. And if you as a player, you're not worrying about your partner and your kids all the time, back all the way back home and what's happening, they're right there with you. And who better to support you than your partner? This makes so much sense. It's amazing.
Caveat to that, though.
Yeah?
What they spoke about is in other teams, let's say two scum ops, mean you're competing for the same position. You get selected. Yeah. Our wives are there. Okinawa spoke about this. If it's not the right people for the environment, those wives are going to be bitchy towards one another because why was my husband not selected? He says that happens. They have experience of that in other environments. So if you bring in families, but that is the way in which it works, then the family is a distraction, essentially, because then the wives are at each other. But the players know we are contributing towards the greater good. The wives know this is not about my husband, this is about Kanka. So if he's not picked, he can feel sad. I'm going to try my best to make him feel better, but it's about the team. It's not about him. It's not about me. It's not about my social media posts and what. It's about the team. So that is an important caveat to that.
Yeah, it's that the wives are also in on the culture, also part of the culture of the book, the partners. Yeah. Wow, interesting one. The last part of the book spoke about execution. We did speak about execution a little bit, about draai jou eie tassie, or carry your own suitcase, but taking responsibility. You also spoke a little bit about tradition and controlling what you can control. What is the thing about tradition? The traditions, I mean, rugby in South Africa is a great tradition in and of itself, and it's almost sacrosanct, some of the things you can do or cannot do and allow to do and not do. So unpack that for us a little bit. How did they shift that?
So that's part of the transformation they spoke about initially, where it is about the way they approach the game, the way they think about it, the way they play it, the way they think you should play, and all sorts of things around that as well. It is, Jacques Nienaber had the question that said, how do you know something is tradition or if it's habit? Because that is quite difficult to distinguish when you think about it. We do this because that's the way we've always done it, because it matters, or we just do it because it's habit. When they, so this team, let's use it as an example, when they came back 2018, team was was losing a lot. And they said, we're going to simplify the way of playing, because 2016, 2017, the team was struggling because they tried to play like the All Blacks. And we didn't have the skill set to be able to do that, and they pummeled us. We had the biggest losses against them during that era. And these coaches came back and say, we're going to just simplify the way of playing. We're going to play to our strengths. These are the traditions of the team. We're going to play with our forwards. We're going to kick high balls. We're going to pressure. We're going to tackle. Won the World Cup 2019. 2020, didn't play any rugby as a result of COVID. Won Lions Tour, came to South Africa, played all the matches in Cape Town, very strange Lions Tour. They played the same way because they said, these players can do this, playing according to our traditional strengths. After that, they realized that the other teams are going to start figuring us out, so we need to evolve. And they had a tough time convincing the players to play differently because the way of playing was so ingrained that they could do that in their sleep. And that is where the likes, as he's showing the likes actually came from, was the coaches giving the permission, the players on the field permission to get out of the mold and to try something else, to counterattack or to not kick or to whatever it is that they said, we are going to work in this way and do it differently. That is how they execute differently now. I mean, this team, 26, last year we saw there's probably three or four different ways the box can play, depending on the opposition, and they can just pull the trigger and play differently. They've got different strings to their bow now. They've been very innovative in not going away from what is traditionally a strength, but enhancing that and adding things to that, which has been incredibly successful. And I think another thing that they've been doing that has helped that is getting outside voices in. It's not just South African coaches. It's experts from across the world who think about the sport differently. And Rassie is the guy who holds everything together because they have an idea of what they want to do. But these guys have important voices to add to it. And as a result of that, you don't just stick to the way you've always done it. You are able to broaden that because there are experts in the room that can help you get out of your mold.
Amazing. That makes it, I mean, that's a tricky thing with tradition, right? Even in business as well, like the things that we've always done it this way. I've had somebody told me that I've been working in this business since 1984. I kid you not. And she goes, and she said, you're not going to tell me what to do differently. Well, maybe that's the problem.
Yep.
The last little bit I saw, Rossi has a 100 item checklist before every test match. Is that the truth?
Oh, they tick it off and they see. So there are obvious big things, team selection, game plan, all sorts of things that they need to prep. But then it also includes things like media events that the players go to and all sorts of things that they try to control. That speaks about controlling everything that you can control. So they try to prep every single detail for a test match. And then at the end of the week, they see we got 93% success rate on this. And then they play the test and they look at, this is how we played. What did we miss? Next week, we need more of this, less of this, so that we can fine-tune as we go through the season continuously. The level of attention to detail and preparation, like I said earlier, it's exhausting, I believe. They just don't leave anything to chance. If there's a thing they can control, they do. Because they know the ball is not round. The ball is the one thing you can't control. It's going to go where it wants to. But everything else, you try to control. And prepare for.
Even down to, I saw you wrote on the 120-day itinerary.
Yes.
So every player is, that's nuts. I can't even imagine that. It's crazy.
So now that we are now mid-June, they spend serious amount of days together. They count the days, they know. And given the fact that they can tell you ahead of schedule which games you're going to be playing, you know exactly where you're going to be on the 7th of September, on the 23rd of October, what flight you're going to be on, what time you need to get up, what you need to eat for breakfast, all of that, you know, barring injury and whatever else comes with the unpredictable things, red cards and so forth. But they know, so they can prepare. And Kitsov said he loves that because he knows when he needs to be mentally switched on, because you can't stay at that mental level forever. He knows that he needs to do what he needs to prep. And then he has two matches against the All Blacks where he needs to be flat out on. And he can prepare himself for that. When that is done, he can tone it down again. Be normal, non-test match playing person.
Yeah. I just imagine what a gift that is. I wish I could have that in my life. Like the next 120 days mapped out, and I know exactly when I need to perform and exactly when I can take it a little bit less and when I need to kind of save up energy because I'm playing the All Blacks next week. And I know that that's going to be the one that I need to save energy for. Like, because, I mean, in the entrepreneurial world, it's just flat out full on every single day, all the time. There's no stopping and no rest. I wonder, maybe there's a way that Even I, or you know, any kind of business leader can go, okay, this is our cycle in here. This is when we need everybody at their best. This is where it's a little bit slower. This is what's happening. Rather than just full on all the time and then creating burnout. Mm. That could be so interesting. Mm. Tell me, PJ,
Sorry, man.
Yeah?
Steven Kitsov said that's the thing when he retired that he missed the most, is the predictability. Now you have to take responsibility for everything yourself. And how do I do this? Because I've never done this as an adult. My life has always been planned. So
I suppose there's a trap in that as well. everything's certain. Somebody told me the other day, if you know everything that's going to happen in your life for certain at this exact moment, it'll take you about a day before you kill yourself.
I think so.
It's like, when you think about it for a second, you go, yeah, that's actually right. Too much certainty is definitely not a good thing. Now, how did this book change you or the process of it on a personal level?
I was surprised for how much I love doing it. Mm. I am the type of person who can, when I start something, I am going to finish it. I thought that I would at some stage get tired of it and just want to get it done. But even after, you know, you've published several books, you go through the iterations of editing and looking at the fine tuning and so forth. I thought that would get boring, but it never was. It was always like, how can I make this better? How can I tweak it? How can I make this as good as I possibly can? And I think also because I love building puzzles, I build jigsaw puzzles quite often. It's a fun way for me to keep my mind engaged without looking at a screen. And it felt like I was putting together a puzzle. All the stuff was there. All the info was there. I just needed to arrange it in a way that made sense, which I love. And I remembered how much I liked writing. Not done this properly in a while. And I've liked it since I was a kid. I always enjoyed writing essays and stelwerk and stuff at school, and you need to do a 2-page essay. I like that, making up stories and so forth. Yeah, I think it's a new territory of my life that is revealing itself, and definitely want to write books again in the future. It's not going to be about rugby again necessarily, but the process of making sense of stuff that's in your head and putting it out there so that it's useful for other people, I really do enjoy that more than I thought. And it's a patient thing, which it teaches you patience, which I appreciate as well.
Yeah, I think that's one of the gifts of writing is this experience of developing ideas. One of my favorite writers and thinkers is Spencer Klavan. And he writes, he says that writing is thinking. And I'm sure you had this similar experience. Like as you write, you think through the thing and you go, oh, okay. It's not like the thing is sort of finished in your head and you just have to transcribe it down onto a page. The act of writing is wrestling and thinking through it. And that's why writing with AI is not necessarily the greatest idea. I think it's a pretty terrible idea. But then because you're not actually thinking. And then the act of writing is the thinking that changes a person.
Mm.
Do you have any idea what your next book is going to be? Everybody's going to ask you that now.
I have a couple of ideas. So there's two ideas that I have. The one might still, because I like sport, the one might be talking to people about the best teammates they've ever had. And having them tell me why that person is a great teammate. So that we can learn from great teammates so that we can be better teammates. Maybe that.
Well, I like that.
Maybe that's something.
I like that.
Yeah. The other thing is, so the other day I was watching an interview of a guy who is a music producer. I never even know that he existed. He's a South African guy, but he's lived in the UK and America his entire adult life. But he's recorded the Beatles and Led Zeppelin and the Rolling Stones and all sorts of incredible bands. And he's a South African guy. So maybe it's about South African people that have been influential that most of us don't even know about. Because we know Russell, we know CR, and we know all the famous ones. But all of these behind the scenes South Africans that have done really cool things. Maybe it's something. I don't know. Yeah. Those are two ideas that I have currently.
Yeah. That's really great. So tell me, Peter, where can people find you online?
You can find me on LinkedIn. That's easy to find. And you can find me on Instagram every now and again. I do tend to turn my social media off every now and again because it's a distraction. But LinkedIn, PJ Klaassen, easy to find. And then also our company website is purposeworks.co.za. So you can find my contact details there as well if you want to talk to me directly. Violet.
Perfect. I'll link to all of those things in the show notes. Tell me, what is one book that changed your life other than the one you've written?
A book that I came across 2 years ago that I tell everybody about. It came at a part of my portion of my life when it was very necessary. It's called, the author is Bruce Feiler, and the book is called Life is in the Transitions. And it's a fantastic book that talks about nobody's life is linear and predictable. And if your life is not linear and predictable, there's nothing wrong with you. I think that book came out in 2021. Really fantastic book. And they did really cool research on a large group of people and talking about their life story to show what is the type of pattern that life can follow. So that was a really fantastic book. I think I've told everybody that I've seen since reading that book about this book. And the other cool book that is very similar to that I'm reading now is the new Jim Cotwell's book, which is called What to Make of a Life. It's very similar type of approach. It's really cool. I mean, he talks about Led Zeppelin as well. So that immediately catches my attention. But it's a cool book about a life. Both these books, life is not something that is predetermined, or we don't need to know the plan. Like you said, the certainty will kill you. And it's okay to figure things out as you go along, but you need to be an active participant in the process of figuring things out, moving forward, not just sitting there and waiting for it to fall into your lap. Those are two really cool examples of recent books that I've read that have been influential. And I think it resonates because life is in the process of getting figured out as I live it. It is not necessarily following the path that I thought. Definitely not certain. It goes with ups and downs, but it's been, I think, yeah, actively participating in that process is why we are here. And being a good, yeah, shining a light while we are here is what we should be doing.
Yeah, that's awesome. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to come and chat to me about all of this and teaching me a little bit more about rugby, seeing I know nothing. So it's really awesome. And thank you so much and all the best with all the stuff and looking forward to your next book.
Thank you, man. It's always good to see you.
Thank you for listening or watching, and thank you for being on this journey with me as we try and figure out and find our way through the fog of life and work. So I've been writing a really short little daily letter that comes out each weekday, and literally very short. It's less than 50 words, and it is a burst of inspiration with some thoughts on strategy, how to find your way, how to become a better human being and do work that matters. You can go to thisispeer.co/daily-letter to sign up and become a part of this community and hear about all the things that we get up to firsthand. Thank you for being a part.